Pod. 22
Pod. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Yeah, I'm doing all right. You know, all things considered, this lockdown and all the shenanigans that go without homeschooling and being stuck on screens. Yeah, it's killing me. But yeah, I guess a lot of people have it a lot worse, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm going a bit. I just feel a bit brain dead for not doing a lot, but you know, it could be worse, as you say.
Yeah, it's just gone on for too long now, isn't it, really? It's just like, oh, come on, a year.
When was the last time you two saw each other then? I think Pat said you went to the Paddington's gig a few years ago.
Yeah. We didn't bump into you then, but obviously we saw you doing your, you know, asserting your art, as it were. But no, that was great. It's a really nice step back in time, really, because I think both Pat and I have been involved with that scene, but that scene stopped being involved with itself for quite a while ago. But it was just nice to get back in touch, and it's amazing how much is the same faces, and it really evokes those same feelings. It's really weird. It's like stepping back in 10 years and all of the same feelings come back. It's really weird, actually.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's like just seeing the same people. I mean, I didn't expect anything less, to be honest, but like it was like, yeah, just seeing everyone again, it was like a proper spirit lifter. It's kind of what we need right now, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. And it's like everyone's there, but they're all a bit older.
Yeah.
I don't remember you like that, but I can see underneath that the aged face, it's you. Of course, yeah. Those people I'm talking about, in my eyes I'm not, but
kind of what this podcast is all about, I guess.
Yeah, nostalgia. Where would it be without you?
Yeah,
I suppose that's a good place to start, really, Adam. Like back in the day when you were in the White Sport with Pat. Like, can you give us an idea of like how you ended up getting into music in general?
Well, I guess getting into music would be listening to it really initially and developing some kind of sense of identity around the cultural tribal stuff. So, yeah, 15, 16, getting into probably the Manchester stuff, you know, watching that, I guess, that classic episode of Top of the Pops with Mondays and Stone Roses and being like a young teen and being blown away by that and thinking, wow, this is really something exciting. So from there, getting heavily involved in buying their records and going to see those bands. I think I just started to play the drums as well around a bit later than that, but.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a place called Bletchley in Milton Keynes, in sunny Milton Keynes.
Did you?
Yeah. Yeah, it was all right. I mean, I guess it's a typical new town, really, you know. There wasn't much. My family weren't musicians or anything. There wasn't much aspiration. People around you kind of either going factories or, you know, getting involved in misdemeanors. So music was never right. You know, I can do this as a career. I just started knocking around on the drums because I quite fancied it and then didn't do anything formal with it really until I got to about 19. I went to college and done a BTEC. I was getting a lot of problems where I grew up on my estate. I was getting to a lot of, light crime and drugs. It was really messy. And at that time in your life, or in my life anyway, there just seemed to be no future. It just means, well, what am I going to do? I've been kicked out of school virtually with no qualifications, so there was no career plan. And was really struggling, I guess, emotionally, psychologically, and managed to wangle this sponsorship type initiative from our local council to go out of Milton Keynes and go to Essex to do a BTEC. So I went there and I realised that if I apply myself and I practised, I could really achieve stuff. And I kind of put two and two together there and thought, well, if I practice lots, I can get quite good at playing. So I've done a lot of practice on piano, guitar and drums. It also helped that I didn't know anyone. It's not like uni where loads of people come in from different towns and all meet. You know, I went to a college and mostly colleges are just local schools. So for the first few months, I had nothing else to do anyway. I was well out of my comfort zone from all my friends from back home. So we just practice. I bought an old keyboard and just started practicing, taught myself how to read piano music and then guitar music and done a bit of drum practice whilst doing this BTEC. That's where it kind of started playing wise for me, I think.
Oh, that's cool. Like, it's really good, like, hearing that, because, you know, coming from a place like Milton Keynes, where you're saying there's not a lot going on, it kind of makes it more inspiring in a way, doesn't it? Like,
yeah,
you know, like when you hear, like, for instance, like the Gallagher story and like where they came from and stuff, it's like it gives kids now, or I think, like, or even whenever, it just, you know, like, coming from wherever you come from, you can still make it. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's the beauty of it, and I think that's the danger of the now, which I guess we'll talk about a bit later. But for me, it was that sense of hope that anyone can, especially, you know, more so in it's probably electronic music now as well, I guess, to an extent, but anyone can make it, and whatever that is. And for me, I was also in a place where I didn't think I could do anything else. It was only from achieving in music that then I got the confidence to try other things later on in life. But if it wasn't for that, achieving something in music, I would have never had that confidence to have even tried anything else, because I thought this is all I can do. It was only after doing that BTEC, and then I didn't think I'd get a degree course, but at that time there was a pop music and jazz degree. There's only two in the country. It's not like now where you got, you know, your BIMs and your BAMs and all these kind of pop music courses. So I got in on that. I think I scraped in through clearing, and that was a 3-year degree, and I was well out of my comfort zone again. You know, people had been to the Royal Academy and the Guildhall weekends, and there's me. I had a very basic level on guitar, drums and piano, and I managed to slide in. And then it was at the end of that, I thought, what am I going to do? So I'd done a teacher training, secondary music teacher training, and got onto that. And every single step of the way, I thought, oh, I've managed to sneak in here. No one's quite found me out yet. And then it comes to the crunch, and they said to me, oh, on your teacher training, we've noticed you haven't got any GCSEs. And of course, I'm teaching in the school. So I had to go and resit English and maths in this kind of makeshift GCSE English and maths course. And then, you know, realizing, well, maybe I can do something else, and teacher training, done the teaching stuff for a bit, enjoyed that, sidestepped into teaching instruments whilst playing in loads of different bands. And then during all those different bands, you know, one got lucky.
So was that based in London, the teaching and everything?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I went from Essex doing a BTEC. Then I'd done, my degree was in Middlesex, but that's based in North London. So I went to North London. And then 3-year degree, then a 1-year postgrad, because I didn't know what I was going to do, teacher training, and then taught in some North London schools. So I was kicking around North London, East London area. And then I ended up shifting from school teaching GCSE stuff to just teaching instruments, because it gave me more flexibility. And then I ended up doing like a 2.5-day week, and then spending the rest of my time practicing and playing in bands. And for me, that was the perfect balance, because I had a good income, you know, in a little basement, damp flat. I could practice my 5-6 hours a day. And in the evenings, I could go out and play in loads of different bands. It was bliss. It was the best time I'd had. And DJing as well, you know, at the current time, doing loads of DJ gigs. So it was a lovely balance, actually.
What was your first band like that you felt like you were, you know, you were happy with? Or
I guess in Milton Keynes, we'd started a band. I think they were called Cirrus Minor, I think. Really, we kind of just get wasted and just play for hours. It was just kind of a Pink Floyd self-indulgent thing. But then when I went to college, I think they started taking it more seriously. And they've done okay in Milton Keynes. But that was the first band I played in. And that was the first sense of what a band might be. You know, being that age, I have all these aspirations and think, yeah, we could make it and we could do something. And being stuck in somewhere like Milton Keynes at a time when it was all from Manchester, it was really quite, I guess it was quite dour. You didn't really know where you were going to fit in. So we didn't really do any shows or anything. We had a singer, but the singer didn't ever want to sing. So it was a bit, it was an interesting concept.
That's difficult.
Yeah. I always thought that was difficult. But, you know, I kind of left them and went to college. And then they, you know, they've done quite a few things in Milton Keynes. So he was a really good friend of mine, actually. His name was David. And he took his own life, like mid-20s. You know, through his own demons, as it were. So that's a big miss. And I think it's always these things that you carry with you in all of the band careers, where I tend to remember those things as well, alongside all the other band stuff. So regarding a band which was, you know, had a big impact initially, would have been them, you know, kicking around with all these guys that were in a similar position to me, really, in Milton Keynes. There was nothing much going on. together and just, I don't know, try to escape the shit life that was around us.
So when it came to getting in bands in London then, was it like through people you worked with or through uni, or how did you kind of mix with people?
Yeah, well, I guess my uni stuff was more jazz people, and they were well, I consider them superior to my level of playing. I, at the same time as doing a jazz degree, I was really into all that stuff. But I also had like a foot in the indie world and was doing just in different bands. And I think the first step I got into that is I was going to a night in East London called Happiness Stands. And there were a load of guys there that were into like breaks and stuff. And they needed a drummer to play onto their backing tracks against their electronic stuff. So I joined that band. They were called Mains Ignition, and they were signed to the label that signed Groove Armada.
What year was this?
I think this was 99. Yeah.
Right.
98, okay. 99. So done electronic stuff with them. And then from that, they were managed by a guy called James Malord. And then when, I guess it was like the early noughties, suddenly there was this real lull. So post Britpop, actually I was in a few little Britpop bands as well during Essex, but there was this real lull post Britpop that had died. You know, we had this lovely time of like 94 to 97, all these great bands coming out again. So in my mind, the big steps were Manchester, and then I guess we had a bit of shoegaziness, and then we had grunge, and then we had Britpop, which was a glorious time. And then that died a bit, and we had kind of a bit of breakbeat, a bit of more of the serene bands like Travis and Elbow and these kind of bands. And then it pumped back up with White Stripes, Strokes, and those kind of bands coming back over. But before that, there was a lot of electronica in East London. And then I started to see a lot more guitars come through. And just as we'd released this electronica album with Mains Ignition, it wasn't electronica, but more electronic, kind of guitars come in and stole that scene. But because James Malord was managing that band Mains Ignition, I think he got me involved with the White Sport. White Sport were initially an electro duo of Andrew Aveling and a guy called Magnus. So I joined them as the drummer. And then there was this huge, really exciting time in East London, this transition. And then the White Sport got more bandy. At the same time, James had met Pete, and he had wanted to get out of the Libertines contract, or wanted to kind of just do more solo writing. So he formed this moniker, Baby Shambles. So at the time, all this stuff was really exciting. So he had one leg in the Libertines still, just contractual obligations. I think there was a lot of tension there. James took him under his wing. And that was the start, really, of that whole scene. We were in the band called the White Sport, supporting Patrick and myself. And I think Patrick and Peter had formed, you know, this alliance together. And then I just ended up fluidly getting involved with that, really. So it was all part of the travelling circus it was moving through.
Yeah, I remember Pat saying that you'd play two gigs at the same night with the White Spot and Baby Shambles. Was that happening at some point?
Yeah, I think Pete was a bass. I think it was our bass. I mean, we couldn't fit enough people in the car, so we were just trying to do cameos. So, right, you can do drums on this. Yeah, so we were supporting, probably that would have been like 2003 maybe or four, supporting Baby Shambles and as the White Sport, and I could see them getting bigger and bigger. Obviously, he'd already got a lot of traction from the Libertines anyway, so a lot of press were interested and a lot of people were following his solo moves. But I could see the band getting bigger and bigger. It was mayhem. In those early days, you know, I wasn't even on stage with him. I could see the level of, I don't know, of just frenzy that was following him, really, more so. So, yeah, supporting that band, and then still playing with Patrick a lot. We'd often just play together anyway, just him and I, just jam. And then, yeah, then the phone call to say, Gemma's not in the band anymore, do you want to join? And that's where it all began, I guess.
Yeah, was it a bit of a no-brainer at that point then?
I don't know, it was a weird one, because I'd started to move in this direction of thinking, okay, I want to do band stuff, but I know that there's not much money in it, so I need to try and pace myself and work out a way where I can continue doing the life I like. So teach 2 or 3 days a week whilst doing music. I was never one of those kind of people that just go, yeah, I'll jump into it and, you know, sleep on couches and stuff. I think I knew I had to make ends meet somewhere, and I knew that all the bands I was in, none of them were making, there's no money in it. So I always knew I had to be quite grown up, as it were, and sensible, and not just throw it all to the wind. So I did think about it overnight, and I thought, God, this would be massive. And if I join, because I could see the trajectory they were on. So I just thought, if I don't do it, I'll always regret it. So I just said yes. And then the next day, gave all my notice in for everything I was doing, teaching jobs, I was in the middle of a master's as well, just gave all of that notice in and just thought, all right, let's just go and see what happens.
Yeah, yes. And then, so what was that, 2004? Or was it 2005?
That was like late 2004 and then early 2005, I guess, when I formally joined them. But that transition was over a couple of months, I think, from Gemma leaving. And it was a crazy time, you know, when I think back to the fights and the arguments, and everyone was in a bad way with drugs. It didn't, to be honest, I didn't think it was going to last. I thought, this isn't going to last, but I'll kick myself if I don't do it. So that would have been very late 2004. And then I joined the band January 2005, I guess more formally, really.
Right. So, I mean, within, I don't know, a matter of days or months, you'd be playing some pretty major gigs. I remember a major, like, Glastonbury Festival slot that summer.
Yeah, or the Brixton one, I always remember. And I remember being on stage because, when Patrick called me, Brixton was the following week. And, I'd done a lot of playing, so I was, I knew I could cope. And because of the jazz background, I knew I could loosely follow and improvise anyway. But some of those songs are quite complex in terms of the shifts. And I remember Pete coming up to me on Brixton and just saying, just follow me. And I'm thinking, what is 7,000 people out there? And then so just following him, and lucky enough, him and Pat had a fight, so that gave me a bit of a few minutes grace to get my shit together. But we didn't even have a drum kit. I think we were using the Cazale's drum kit, and he's a great drummer, but he plays a real distinct way of having his drum set up really low. So I'm on this kit which feels really foreign. I'm trying my best to play songs I don't know, and he's just starting songs that I've never even heard. And I'm thinking, there's a lot of people out there watching me. So it was a bit of an initiation of fire. So when that fight kicked off, it was a bit of a relief, really. I was like, oh, thank God that happened. Yeah.
That was the beauty of Pete, though, wasn't it? And not the fighting, but, just so spontaneous, I guess.
Yeah, and I like that. I think for me,
The fans loved that as well. Like, there was just something different about it. Compared to other bands.
Yeah, and that's what's great with it. I think because I can follow that kind of stuff, I can just, I guess, same with Drew in a way, and same with Pat, we can all kind of half improvise, so we can all just meander around whatever he's doing, and whatever drugs are flowing, we know it's going to be slower or faster than it was the night previously as well. But I found that really exciting. I think initially, having that initiation, which was quite different to other bands, especially playing venues that size, it set me up really, and I thought, okay, well, this is how it's going to be. It's going to be pretty much off the cuff. And I think my own personality as well finds that maybe it's that addictive part that really is drawn to hyperstimulation. Although it's exhausting, it's also really exciting. There's something I'm drawn to about that as well.
Yeah, I imagine when you kind of pull it off and it all comes together, it must be a very good feeling.
It is, and it's not a very good feeling when it doesn't get to yeah. This is the other side of it.
I was actually watching the gig yesterday. I think someone only uploaded it this week, but it's when you played the 100 Club from that year.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
And it seemed a similar thing. I think maybe you're just getting your head around some of the songs, and like, it all seemed like quite loose at that point. But I guess that was part of the excitement of it, I guess.
Yeah. And I think everyone was loose as well. I think, whether that be through drugs, through drink, through just the emotional turmoil that was going around, he was. Under those years, I mean, Pete was part of such pressure. He had these two big bruises, like ex-military people from rough trade on his back. He was under curfew. He couldn't breathe. He had the press hounding him with massive struggle with substance. And it's kind of no wonder that it was such a ramshackle, but it was a very exciting time.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously we talked to Pat about, what it was like being in the band and stuff, but just trying to get an idea of like the day-to-day of being in Baby Shambles, because obviously it's quite unique to any other band. And I saw an interview where you said there's a lot of peaks and troughs, and that you actually used to treat every show as if it was your last. Is that kind of your attitude at the time?
Yeah, I think so. I think we never knew whether you know, the level of drugs and stuff that was being knocking about, you never knew. You thought, is this going to continue? People coming in and out of the band, management, labels. There was so much friction and tension. It wasn't like a plain sailing band where you look at your diary and say, okay, well, come November, we'll have a few months off, then we'll do this. It just wasn't like that. It was day by day living. And you just have to take it like that. I think it calmed down a bit during the later years. But in that initial period, it was literally like it was either going to implode or explode. That's how I've sensed it anyway. So for me, it was just like, well, climb aboard and just hold tight and see where it takes you.
Yeah, I mean, Tom, you were around at that time. Was that kind of part of all the excitement? Like you didn't know what was going to be around the corner kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously for us as a band, it was different. But yeah, touring, like the excitement around that for us. I mean, we were fans, obviously, as well. Like we, when we started off as a band, we were fans of the Libertines and what have you. But, you know, at the start of the Shambles as well, I think before you were introduced into the band as well, weren't it, Adam? You know, if we were invited on any tour or whatever, it was like, yeah, you never knew what was going to happen. And we were just buzzing to be supporting anyway, because it was just like, you couldn't be in a better position as a support band, I don't think, at the time, because it was just so exciting. And like you say, you never knew what was going to happen. You didn't even know if the show was going to happen some night.
Exactly.
And then you didn't know whether you were going to end up on what bus you were going to end up on, or whether you were going to end up in a riot band or something.
Yeah, that sums it up.
Kind of how it was. And it was fun. Like, not that it's cool to get arrested or anything and like do drugs, but it was fun at the time. And like, it was part of the dream, I guess, in the back of our heads when we were growing up.
Yeah. And I mean, we talked to Pat about, you know, the fact when you are having to cancel gigs and everything, and you guys are kind of left there with your drumsticks in your hands. What was that feeling like? Did you ever have points where you thought, yeah, I can't do this anymore, or you thought you might have to do something else?
It's horrible. I think the most, you know, the demanding time is when it'd normally be Drew and I left there, and you can almost cry because of the atmosphere. There were so many sad people there, and there was so many, you know, they're waiting to see their idol, as it were. I mean, we never got blamed for it. You know, people never accused us because they could see we were there in that sense. But yeah, there was that disappointment. And I think after so many of them, what tends to happen is you start to, edit your own excitement, because you don't know whether it's going to happen or not. You tend to not get that, not as excited as you did, because you think, well, I don't want to get too excited in case it doesn't happen. So during the periods when it was really turbulent, it was difficult, because there was the excitement, you never knew what was going to happen. But when it got bigger and you knew you were kind of letting people down, it weren't so much that rebellious nature anymore. Do you know what I mean? It's a bit like, God, people have kind of bought hotels and stuff like that. And there was that element of like, I don't think this is very fair anymore. But on the side of it, I think, you know, he was doing what he was doing. And when you're in deep in those places, how many of us really think about the other in that sense?
Was there ever a time where you'd have to like have a word with him, or you try and change? I mean, it wasn't just Pete, I guess. Pat said, you know, he had a problem as well. I mean, did you try and talk to him, or how did it work?
Not really. No, I knew, I kind of, you know, I knew my place in that band effectively. It's like, I can, and everyone will be full of apologies and will never do it again, but it kind of falls on deaf ears really. And there was a bit of just acceptance of this is what it is. And a bit of resignation in that sense as well. It's a bit like, okay, well, I do have a choice here. I don't have to be in this if I don't want to be. And I'm choosing to be. And I can subtly try to put things in place, you know, making sure people can maybe go and pick him up. When James Malore wasn't around any longer, because that was James's job. James would literally spend the night with him to get him on the bus. And I remember being like, on the start of every tour bus would be parked up outside his house for an hour, 2 hours, 4 hours, 8 hours, sometimes for 24 hours, we'd just be stuck on this bus waiting. And then the bus would go without him, and he'd say, oh, he'd catch us up. And then he'd say, oh, yeah, I'm just popping to Paris. And just like, no, you've got a show in an hour. So it was those kind of things. It was just, when I think back, it was mayhem, really. It was real mayhem. But there was a sense of, after that happens, goes on for a few years, there's a bit of resignation. It's just a bit like, okay, well, let's not get too excited in case it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, Pat told us about the time, the Oasis gig, where apparently Liam ended up booting your gear or something because he was frustrated.
Yeah, well, that was my that was my chance to shine.
Of course it was, Milton Keynes, yeah.
No, it's Milton Keynes Bowl. This is Freddie Mercury, REM, like big players. And there I would have been, you know, my homecoming. And I remember being on this little minibus and getting later and later. And then suddenly you hear that he's with Kate somewhere and she can't wake him up. And then you hear kind of Liam or Noel on the phone saying, that's it, fuck you. We're never going to play with you again. We're not going to. Because, you know, they were really, they were kind of, at one point, Noel was offering us the mantle of rock and roll. And that would have been a huge, big deal. And I think we would have sidestepped more into that fan base as well. Because we were always on the periphery, I think, because of the nature of the drugs and the politics. That kind of Britpop fan base were always a bit reluctant to get involved. And unfortunately, yeah, it's like a bit of a killer. Maybe we'll make it up sometime down the line. But I really wanted that gig. I would have loved it. That would have been my homecoming, but it didn't happen.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. You mentioned Kate Moss and everything, and when it comes to Pat leaving, he said he left because of the whole circus that was going on, which you didn't really delve too much into, but what were your thoughts at that time when he left? Could you understand why he left?
I didn't really understand why he left, whether it was like a, because even, you know, when I relate that to when I left, stroke got kicked out, it just ends up in such turmoil that you're not sure whether you've been kicked out or you've left. And I think those two were quite close, and I don't really know what went on. I think maybe, I don't know whether it was the whole kind of Kate Moss thing that got in the way, but I can relate to it on that level, and I can see how it did just get more and more crazy. I know Pat was going, you know, down further into a deep hole. I'm sure he's told you about his own stories, but as one of my best friends, you know, there came a point where I was no longer going to go and get him out and, you know, get his guitars back and work out all that stuff for him. And it became progressively more difficult. I think as a bit more kind of money came in, obviously that money goes to other places where it's going to self-destruct. And that was what was happening. It felt like it's going to implode. We kind of did. I think the implosion of that band happened in 2006 before the Blinding EP. You know, Pat was no longer in the band. Peter had gone to rehab and then been kicked out of rehab. He's wandered around Arizona desert somewhere. It's just like, okay, this is over now. And I honestly thought it was. I thought the whole thing had collapsed, but it was a good fun year. And I was just thinking about, okay, what can I do now? I can do a bit more teaching, you know, try and join some other bands. But I thought it was over, really, at that point.
Was that the same year as the Arena documentary, I think, I was watching? And it's interesting watching your interviews in that, because you almost took on more of a manager-type role, or you kind of helping management organise things. Is that kind of the role you fell into a little bit?
Yeah, so for probably after that period, I thought, well, if someone doesn't grab the reins on this, the whole thing's going to collapse. You know, even maybe from a selfish perspective, trying to keep it together. Yeah, I'd call around, like, you know, call around to Kate's PA, see where Peter was, get him out. Just trying to just generate some form of motion within the band. And at that point, we'd been booked into yeah, rough trade. I was trying to organise getting re-signed to them, just so there was some element of motivation, because there was nothing. We were free floating. Rough Trade didn't want to sign the band. They wanted to sign Peter Solo, which actually left a bit of a sour taste in my mouth, seeing as I was running around like a headless chicken, getting them all of their press campaigns sorted out. But, you know, end of the day, money talks, and it's a business, isn't it? But so there was that. And then we'd been, one saving grace is we'd been booked to play a festival in 2006, Get Loaded Festival. And just as they'd started to roll the press out, I think it must have been March, April, they're trying to sell this festival on the back of us because we're headlining. And Peter got arrested and put away, and they didn't know whether they were going to bail him. And this guy that was running the festival, he also owned Turnmill Studios in East London, Farringdon. So I think Peter was in and out of rehabs and stuff. And he said to us, look, to generate some more good press and interest, why don't you just come and use the studio? So we did. So we went there and kind of decamped to that studio and just plotted up there for a few months, and just put some demos together, which was a Blinding EP. And then from that EP, managed to get a deal with Parlophone Records, and they signed then two albums and that EP. So we were really lucky at that point. But this was before the whole industry collapsed as well.
Was this when Drew stepped in? Was it you and Drew stepped in a bit with the writing? Or was that a bit later on?
Well, we'd done a bit of that. I think we definitely had more space to do some of that stuff. Yeah, so the Blinding EP, we'd all kind of contributed towards. So we were doing all that, and we were just trying to instigate any sense of any movement, some traction, because the whole thing was the press weren't interested. It was kind of written off, I think, at that point. And then this Get Loaded Festival really saved it, and this guy called Danny Newman put us in Turn Mills to do the Blinding EP. And that was pretty shoddily recorded, but the mixer Chenzo Townsend, I think he'd done a great job of mixing it, re-miking it, all that kind of stuff through different rooms, and it made it sound great. And it really reignited all of us, and the Parlophone deal helped, and off we were back again.
Quickly going back to, you know, you kind of in the management side of things, you said it's a lot to do with who Pete trusted as well, and we didn't really ask Pat too much about that, but I mean, was there a sense that there were a lot of people around trying to get the most out of the situation, if you like take advantage? Were you aware of that at the time?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was a level of trust between us at that point, because we've been through a lot together. I think in the nature of any business, there's going to be, you know, he was probably a very lucrative person to know, and he's also a very charitable person. He's very giving as well, sometimes too giving. And I think people take advantage of that as well. So I think there was this reluctance to trust lots of people. And most of the time you trust these people and then they do turn out to kind of squeeze you a bit dry, especially in the music industry. It's renowned for that level of playing field. But yeah, I think that trust thing, yeah, that helped. I think because there was that level of trust, we'd all come through. And there were people on the periphery trying to get access to hear more so. That helped to kind of reclose it down into a small community with just us.
Just looking back at documentary, I wanted to ask you this question because I was watching Who the Fuck is Pete Doherty? And everyone seems to be in like normal places getting interviewed. Yeah, yeah. And then you're active strip club in the background with you.
Well, a guy called Roger Pottery, I think. Was that his name? Yeah. Yeah, I think he's no longer with us, sadly, but he suggested it to me. He said, do you want to meet in Soho and you can do your interview? I went, yeah, okay. And he said, meet me here. And it was right next door to Jazz After Dark. So I thought, okay, Jazz After Dark. And I got to Jazz After Dark and I realised it was the door before. And there he was. And I went, okay. So I just went with it. It's kind of like, I didn't really know. I just, you know, you do what you're told. And it's, all right, cool. But in hindsight, yeah, maybe it wasn't the best of choices as I get a bit older.
Now, I'd love to say I listened to what you were saying, but I was a bit distracted.
Yeah, me too. Don't know what.
And then, I wanted to ask you about your memories of the NME Awards in 2006. And I mean, obviously for an experienced musician like you, it might not have been a big deal, but I noticed you had the Strokes sat right in front of you when you're playing Albion, I think. Right. Just wondered what events like that were for a band like Baby Shambles, and whether, you know, you would get nervous or you weren't really bothered about things like that.
Was that the one where we stood up? I can't remember. Was that the one where
it's a bit like half acoustic kind of almost?
Right, yeah. Yeah. I don't even know what I was doing. I think we come off the back of a tour, and I think we'd all been up for a long time. So to be honest, it would have just blurred into this, all right, you've got to be here, you've got to do this song, and you've got to move on. I think I've seen a photo of myself scarfed, and I think I was just on a bit of another planet, to be honest. I don't really remember much. I think those tours, the further you get into them, the more it becomes surreal. And I think that was in the middle of the tour. And I don't really remember other people being there. I don't really even remember being there myself, to be honest. But I've seen some photos, so I know I was there. So unfortunately, I can't really tell you what that was like.
That's all right. Yeah, I suppose I have thought about that. Like, I've not obviously not been in a touring band, but your whole lifestyle has become pretty odd or surreal, like you say. Obviously, you've experienced that as well, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking earlier on, like, when we even first met Adam, like, I honestly, I can't remember. And like you were saying, everything just blends into one, and you do feel like you're on another planet sometimes, because you are in a completely different world to everyone else, and unless you're in it, I guess you don't know what it's like. And you are just getting ushered from venue to venue, or, like, you know, all these parties or, like, award shows and stuff like that. And yeah, I guess that's just the way it is, isn't it?
It's too fast, isn't it? It's just too fast. Because
I have
memories of parties, and I think, did that party happen?
Yeah, I wish I could go back and just, like, try and... I actually wish I'd, like, documented it more than we did, because it's just some of the shit that happened, and, like, some of the laughs, and, like, the good memories and the weird memories. Like, I wish I could watch them back sometimes now, because, yeah, it's just madness most of the time, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just too fast, I think, for the normal brain to be able to even comprehend. You know, if you have exciting stuff happen to you, you might go and have a week on a bend or whatever, but then you kind of come back and touch base, and your brain can download it all. But there were times when, like I say now, I'll have a dream. I thought, did that happen, that party, or was that a pure fabrication? It was just too fast. And it wasn't just it was too fast, that even on the days off, you know, there was a flurry of phone calls of, because I think Peter was so in demand coming through me. Can he do this? Can you get hold of him? If he does this, he can do that. And it's like, wow, just, you know, really exciting, but really traumatizing on the other side of it. I think I'm still recovering now.
Yeah, I suppose there's not really a lot of time to think or take it in when you're going through all that.
No. And it was very fast, you know. Then not only was it fast, there's all sorts of substances flying around. So you're kind of not in your what I call your prefrontal cortex anyway. You know, you're another planet.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, again, you might not have much memory of it, it's just that infamous Pop World interview. Was that just off the cuff, like, just Pete decided he wasn't interested? Or what was the thinking behind that?
It was a weird one, because, like, I think none of us were interested. And I think because of the whole vibe of the band not being interested, someone like that gets really disarmed. You know, I think there's always a weak link in a band where someone will feel a bit uncomfortable for not giving the interviewer what they want. But we were just all like, nonchalant. Oh, yeah, I can't be bothered with you. So bless him, you know, he worked quite hard. But it is one of those classic interviews. And I certainly didn't have anything of interest that I wanted to say. Or
are we talking about Amstel?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was on the Fuck Forever video, wasn't it, with the in the farm?
Yeah.
We've just got our hands in our pockets. I think also it'd been a late night as well. So we were, you know, probably hanging. And it's like, we've been out all night, I think. And then we had all ended up in Brick Lane. And this is where they filmed the Fuck Forever video. I remember just being so spaced out and tired and groggy and calmed down. And that horrible mixture. And then there's someone, you know, really enthusiastic, and it's like, oh, I really can't be bothered.
Yeah, there's literally no intentions of trying to be rude, but you're just literally done in. It's like, yeah. You can't help it.
And just trying to understand what he's saying. It's like, you know what, I don't have enough brain power left to even understand your words, let alone give you any of mine.
To be fair, you'd not even listen to the song, so.
Yeah.
It's quite funny, that. was that Hackney Farm or something?
Yeah, that was just behind Brick Lane. Yeah, ah, still okay. There now. So then we got the donkey involved and all sorts.
Yes. And then, yeah, like I guess moving on to the second album. And like you say, you're getting, you know, you're back on a more secure record deal. Did things start to get a bit more professional? Because I remember coming to see you at that point at like an arena, I think it's Nottingham Arena. Did the gig start to become a bit more bigger and slicker kind of thing?
I think so, yeah. I think there was two things there. The band had become much more pro. I think Stephen Street had really helped us cement everything together. I think we needed to. I think it would have fallen apart without someone kind of putting a hand in and saying, I think you can do better. And then the label signing you for that much money are going to want you to deliver the goods. You know, Rough Trade can take a few kind of no-shows and studio misdemeanors, but I think they wanted more. So I definitely felt that we could step up and give it more polish, and we did. But yeah, I think it was much more professional. But with that, there was a bit of boredom with it. I just felt we'd lost something. I felt maybe as a band, those kind of places, it's great to play for my own ego and do the arenas, but I definitely felt really disconnected and a bit sterilized. Yeah, there was something about that. You know, you drive in, you drive under, you don't really see anyone, you don't really see the crowd. I don't know, I felt a bit lonely during those times, to be honest.
Yeah, like the whole part of that band and most of the bands around that time and in that scene, the whole, like, the half of it was like the interaction with the fans, and the relationship was just like, you know, when it changes into all the big stuff, it just, you don't know, it doesn't get boring. It's obviously like, it's, that's the dream still. It's like to be playing in front of more people and whatever, but yeah, you just, it does lose something, doesn't it, when you play the bigger shows?
Yeah, I thought that. I thought, you know, you're so far back from the audience. I definitely felt more disconnected from the audience there. Yeah, you know, even money-wise, those things don't pay as much as some of the smaller gigs. But I think there was a plan from the management that taking over, a little bit more corporate, that wanted to plan a real career path. And at the time, it felt like a good idea. It's only in hindsight, and I look back now, and I, you know, when we were just talking about those days of the 100 Club and going up and down the M1, the M6, there was something really invigorating about that. And by the time we'd got to like 2007, 2008, it's like, I don't know, there was just something a bit stationary about it. It didn't have that drive anymore. It didn't have that real energy and that vigor.
Yeah, I guess the whole scene was maybe, I don't know. Losing its edge a little bit.
It was, but it's like any sort of Britpop as well, isn't it? If you look at these, same as Manchester stuff, I think you have 2-3 golden years and then everyone jumps on it, saturates it, and then that implodes it. And then you're left with a few scattering ones which make it through that, which is the nature of any scene. You know, a label will see it and they'll think, okay, let's jump on this and make it, do as much as we can with it. And it was weird how the guitar scene just died after that, and it hasn't really regained, I don't think. I think maybe.
Yeah, I agree. Real.
But I sense that. I sense that we were on the dying edge. And then, you know, as my involvement with the band kind of come to an end, 2010-11 time, it was, the scene was changing. You know, it really was. The kind of the guitar stuff was going down. And it still hasn't really recovered, I don't think. And maybe it never will, because of the diversity now. And obviously, you know, much more, I guess, led by technology. You know, different stuff. Grime was coming in, which is huge now.
It's just so easy to make music from your bedroom. Like, it's the world's completely different in every sense, in it. So, like, yeah, like you say, you never, it's sad though, isn't it? Because, like,
yeah, I
see. Like, when things come back round again, because I've always been like, oh, yeah, this could. Guitar music's going to be cool again soon and whatever, and it just hasn't happened.
No, and I'm waiting. And for me, you know, I guess thinking back to guitar music of, you know, late, or even that, you know, even late 80s before Baggy, so indie stuff, you know, you're talking about bands like the Smiths and Jangle Pop, that was still guitar music that then merged into Baggy. And although Baggy was dance-based, it was still band-based. And then we had the little dive, and then we come back up with grunge and Britpop, and the little dive, and it come back up with, I guess, the naughty stuff. And for me now, it's been going on too long. It's like, this has got to happen, but I'm not sure. You know, I'm really not sure. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm just cynical, but I would love nothing more than that stuff to come back. And it must do at some point, because people must be getting bored now with this kind of R&B tinge, grunge, kind of, not grunge, grime, like, you know, rapping on everything. And it's just, everything just seems a bit sedate. Everything, there's nothing really I don't know, nothing in your face and angry as such that I can hear from maybe my own genre that I'm interested in.
Yeah, I think I saw you maybe posted about someone's take on the age of streaming and maybe how unfair it is in terms of the pay through. Is that something you kind of feel maybe is hampering people starting out in music?
Yeah, massively. I think what you're going to do, because venues are shutting, you know, all these things are kind of difficult to go out and do, was even in the naughty stuff, there were a lot of little venues. You know, you could go and tour, you could go up north, you could go to Scotland, you could go to London. But, God, especially now during COVID, but I had this lovely thought the other day that if all these offices that no longer want their premises and stuff move out of London, the prices are going to drop, which means things that don't earn so much money and aren't so safe, like little gritty venues, can hopefully move back in. Maybe there'll be a whole new post-COVID scene, who knows? But, yeah, I think it's hard. I think for young bands now, it's so difficult. You know, you've got to do social media stuff and all of this, and sometimes that really goes against the ethics and the ethos of your band. You're having to post so much content all the time. It's really hard. I don't know if I would have done it now. I think if the environment was like this when I was just starting out, I'm not sure I would have been as drawn to it, to be honest.
I mean, that's a question we do ask people, is if they were starting out now, like, how they anticipate it would be different. And I guess that's what you're saying. You don't know if you would have been as excited by everything.
Yeah, it wouldn't have felt like it would maybe would have been achievable. Was, you know, I was growing up around the bands that had come from almost nothing and made a success of it. There's not that many anymore that I know of. I think there's a lot of small operating ones, but it's not the same. You know, and you've got to do whatever, 2-3 hours social media, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. And the environment, you know, look at even the charts and stuff. I don't know anything in the charts. I kind of catch up with them every now and then, especially when I was DJing more contemporary stuff. And I don't really like it. I don't really, doesn't move me. There's no names I know. And it's never been for me as stark as it is now in that sense. But again, maybe that's, you know, a testament to my age and the kind of music I'm into.
I mean, Pat mentioned that he wished he'd recorded more. Is that something you realised you had to start producing more albums? And obviously had the record deal as well.
He said, what did he say? He said he wished he'd done more recording.
He said he enjoyed recording. He wished he'd recorded more with the band, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was so much material as well floating about. It's why Down the Album was so big in that sense. But, yeah, I think I wish we had have done less of the touring of Shotters Nation after a year or two maximum. And then, you know, got back in the studio. But I guess the allure of playing bigger festivals and money was detrimental in that way. Because I think sometimes you can only play the same songs for so long. Then you're just treading water, really. It's that balance, isn't it? It's the balance between being creative and I guess, earning a living.
At what point were you starting another band? Is it Roses, Kings, Castles? Well, was that alongside me. Baby Shambles?
Yeah, and that's just me. I was writing songs. And some of them were a bit twee and melodic, so I thought they're not going to work. So I just done a MySpace, the classic MySpace thing, in about 2007. I remember writing stuff in my hotel rooms during the arena tours because I think I was missing that creative element. I think there was nothing happening creativity-wise. So I just started writing that stuff and put it under that moniker. Then the first album, I played it all myself, played all the instruments, recorded it, and went out and just... I only done solo gigs at that point.
Yeah, were you playing guitar and singing those songs?
Yeah. I kind of just, I could play basic guitar. But again, it was a bit of an initiation of fire, really. And there was nothing happening in the band. So I just started going out and doing these little solo things. Yeah, it was quite a nice, exciting time, really.
Yeah, was that quite like a nice release, kind of on the side of Baby Shambles?
Yeah, because I'd go out when things were paused. So if they were touring, I'd come back and then do a few solo shows or DJ shows and then go back out on tour. So it was quite a nice creative outlet to get stuff moving and having a bit of autonomy and agency as well, because something like Baby Shambles, sometimes your hands are tied. There's only so much you can do. So it was nice to be able to go out and just write some stuff and throw it out there on MySpace, which is the good thing about technology. You know, you can get it straight out there, back in the days of the MySpace generation.
And you touched on it earlier, but were you getting more involved with the writing side of Baby Shambles?
Yeah, I started to do a lot more writing, do writing with Peter and stuff. But I think with him, you have to really have knuckled down for a good 2-3-4 day sitting to get those rights with him. And I don't think I had that stamina ever. I think you had to be kind of floating on a similar stream to go down that path. So it wasn't that easy. But there's some co-writes that were in Shotters Nation and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's what Pat said is, yeah, they'd end up just sitting in a living room for a few days hammering songs out.
Yeah, and hammering other stuff out as well. But you know, it can get quite dark. But for me, it's like, yeah, you know, I guess I've indulged and my own mild contextually struggles, but that's another level.
Coming to the time where you left the band, Adam, like I saw you said it's very difficult to go into detail at the time, so I don't expect you to now. But yeah, how would you reflect on that time? Can you tell us a bit about what happened?
I was really horrible. I think it was a real sterile time in the band anyway. I think at this point, we just recorded Peter's solo album and we were waged as musicians. So already you have a massive big power shift. And I think the management obviously knew that it was probably easier and more lucrative. So there's already, you know, cracks in the foundation, really. There was a lot of, you know, infighting. And it got to the point where I just went to, we were going to go on tour at some point, and Drew and I were told, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to be in a band with you anymore. Generally, when that happens, I go, yeah, okay, bumble along. And a few days later, everything's forgotten. And at this point, something had just switched. And I just thought, all right, cool. That's that then. And it was like a real weird, maybe it was just my body taking over and saying, you've had enough. And that was that. It was pretty, you know, I was all over the place anyway. I was really sad. I was really quite jubilant that I was no longer in it. There's a real mixture of emotions. But as I look back now, I think it was probably the best thing I could have done, really. I didn't walk away. I was kind of pushed. It was, I think, in a similar vein with Pat, it's like, well, were we kicked out or did we leave? Or was it a case that we were kicked out as we were often kicked out, but we just lost we just couldn't be bothered and weren't motivated to kind of get back in, if that makes sense. It was such a murky, messy well between who was in the band. You know, one minute the general's going to be the new bass player, the next minute some guy's meeting East London's going to be the manager. The whole thing was always in disarray. So you just took those things in your stride. One minute, you know, one-armed Bob from Glasgow is going to be the drummer. And you're like, okay, right, cool. And but, you know, they would maybe do a gig or something and then it would come back to the core band and you just flexed with it. But at this point, I was like, no, I just had a child. And it's like, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I can't drive backwards and forwards, picking people up, making sure you're there for a gig. So I think something inside me just clicked and I was like, all right, cool, see you. And that was that.
So who's telling you this? Is it Pete that's often saying, yeah, well, you're not in the band anymore?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Very odd.
Well, I think that's indicative of the psychological state of everyone was in. It was just such a blurry mess.
I think when it got to that point as well, like there was just so many people like coming in and out of like this group and you didn't really know who any of them were because, you know, because of like the intoxication of everything as well, it was like, there was a lot of hangers on in that sense as well, weren't there? Like,
yeah,
people trying to make money out of him, probably through drugs as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was a mess.
He literally didn't. I remember just be like showing up to certain things, and you know, usually you'd know like everyone who was part of the crew or whatever, but then there'd be like this random people like coming in and out. And
yeah,
it would just be weird friendships.
And that was it. And I remember one particular time, I think you lot had come up for a party in where he was in Marlborough. And I think for me, that was like the party's over. You know, there was some celebration, some birthday or something. There was a lot of old people there. Now, by old people, I meant like old band mates that we'd all be friends with and old faces. And then there was this new scene happening. And for me, I was at that party and I remember you lot all being there. And I remember some other kind of, I guess, of our peers being there, and then this whole crew of new, and I just thought, you know what, this just feels wrong now. It just feels like it's about to explode, and it was dark. And it's at that point, it's only a few weeks after that, I think, where the whole thing kicked off. And yeah, I just felt it. I think everyone felt it as well. This is it now. It's gone as far as it can go.
And you mentioned, obviously, but did you feel part of a unique scene back in the day, like when when you're first in the Baby Shambles or even White Spot?
Yeah, I could sense it was, there was something really exciting happening, but the more I became involved with it, the more I didn't realise how special it was until after it all stopped, really, to be honest. But yeah, initially, when I was on the outside of it, it felt very special, very raw, very fast and very energetic.
Yeah, and was there a, like, is there a high point you can think about?
I think definitely the high point for me would have been within the first year, year and a half, 2 years. The high points would have been those first exciting gigs, you know, touring the world when we were a ramshackle unit, when the police weren't so much on our back and the media, I guess the media was hot, but it wasn't as sinister as it got. Yeah, doing things for the first time, you know, when you kind of fly over to Ibiza and do the big clubs first time and do the big festivals, that's massive as well. Then after a few, two or three times, it's a bit like, oh, this has got, the V Festival's got great lamb chops in their catering. stuff like that. And you just take it a bit more in your stride. So yeah, the first year, I'd say, all that first year.
And is there anything you do differently about any of your time in music, really?
I mean, regarding that band, yeah, I'm not sure I would have maybe tolerated as much as I did in hindsight. Yeah, I think there's not much more I could have done. I guess there's certain people that I maybe facilitated into the fold that in hindsight I wouldn't have trusted so much. But yeah, other than that, yeah, it is what it is. And I don't really have any regrets. As I look back now with more time, I do think that I got out at the right time. I don't know what kind of a wreck I'd be if I had stayed in as it really started to sink.
Drew must have quite a lot of resilience that it's gone straight from that to being in Liam Gallagher's band, doesn't he?
Well, it's pretty contained now, you know, I think maybe in the wilder days, but I think now it's a pretty slick unit now. But I guess both Drew and I are quite dissociative, which means we're quite good at just cutting stuff off and getting on with it, which unfortunately comes back and bites you. But at the time, you're about to just kind of cut off and just kind of try and find some inner calm or peace and distance yourself from the chaos.
And I guess I didn't mention kind of the Libertines aspect, like you left around the time they were getting back together. Was that kind of always looming over the Baby Shambles a little bit, or is it not something you gave too much thought to?
Really, I think there was a lot of kind of contempt. I think there was a lot of anger towards what had gone on in the Libertines. Yeah, I mean, it didn't really ever come up. Maybe towards the latter part, I think as our band started to not be able to sell out some of those bigger venues, you know, I guess they were Carling Academies back then. You know, we started to struggle to sell out your Sheffields and your places like that. You could see that the demise of the band was going, and we weren't recording new stuff. So I thought it was only a matter of time, really. And from that, I guess the Libertine was quite a lucrative offer because, you know, a chance to rekindle that fan base. And in all fairness to them, they'd done all the groundwork before Baby Shambles. You know, they'd set us up nicely, really. They'd teed us up nicely. But I don't, you know, I'm good friends with Gary. And I remember even on the first Baby Shambles sessions, doing some drumming on them, and Gary would come in, he'd do a bit, I'd then do a bit. But he's just one of those guys that is so friendly and a wholesome, good guy, that you can never say anything bad about him. But regarding the rest, I don't know. I've never met real Carl really. And I've not really ever met John either.
Yeah, is it a bit like football with the goalkeepers union? Is there a bit of a drummers union as well?
I think probably anyone that meets Gary is like that with him.
Yeah.
Like I say, he's one of those rare people that I don't think he's got any enemies.
Yeah.
You know, he's just such a solid, wholesome person. I think it'd be difficult to not like him. I don't know. I think people just really respect him for that. I think he's very level-headed. I mean, there's no bullshit, but with it, it's just really grounded. So we've always got on, and we've done this drum DJ thing as well after that, together, this London Guns thing before the Libertines got back together, and we were doing like live drumming and DJing together, which was going all right, but we're just trying to work out how to do it, you know, touring Europe and stuff with that. And then Libertines got big, so off he went. So that was that, really.
And we've mentioned briefly Oasis, but we always try and get a Gallagher story out of people just in case. Yeah. I've got a funny one to tell. I suppose you have.
I did have, and I've forgotten it. And I know Noel was there backstage at Brixton Academy. And I think I may well be fantasizing this and making it up, but I think he said, "You guys smashed it tonight, and I'm going to hand the rock and roll mantle over to you." And in my mind, he gave it to me. I'm not claiming that or anything, but you know, as a member of the band, this could well have been a dream, as a caveat to that. But I think there was definitely something like that that went on, which was quite a nice thing, you know, because I think his most, I guess, people that are into the indie stuff, it's, you know, he's up there with the best, really.
Yeah, he always had like a nice word to say about Baby Shambles or Pete's music, didn't he? But just a bit the opposite with Liam, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, and I've not really met Liam, to be honest. I've always preferred Noel's solo stuff anyway. I think he just doesn't stick to formula. And, you know, he writes them himself, and there's no harm in getting songwriters, but I think I always have a bit more respect if you do. And if you think, well, maybe this won't, you know, get to top 40, but it's what I'm writing, and that's that. I guess it's different between being a commercial artist and a creative artist in that sense.
Moving on to your, like, current stuff, Adam, and obviously saw your post about Tonic Rider. Is that mental health support for musicians?
It is, yeah. I often get asked to do groups and stuff, and sometimes it doesn't feel right for me. But regarding Tonic, I've always liked what they do because they offer mental health support, but they also use music. So it's kind of like pseudo music therapy, and they're a very small little community-based thing in Portsmouth. But I think, you know, Terry Hall's involved, Barry Esquire from Bez, they're all really involved, really organic. So they do these charity events. And it's just caring the community in that sense, is trying to help people to use music, songwriting courses. And they've just launched a bigger initiative to do online peer support groups during COVID for musicians and people in the music industry. So when they contacted me, I said, yeah, you know, I think it's such a shit time that I'd be happy to give something back. So that's how I got involved with them. So I'm just going to be running a weekly, like hour and a half peer support group, really, with a bit of psych education for people to get them through in these current times. Because to be honest, I think there's not enough musicians or ex-musicians or whatever coming forward. You know, there's an awful massive gap between your big players that don't need to tour every other year and people that are really doing it because they need to pay their rent from doing, you know, a 2-week tour every 2 months. So for me, it's just like, it's really important for anyone that's got any weight in the industry to give something back and not stand back and leave it to other people, really.
Tommy, you mentioned you could have done with some more guidance back in the day. Is that something that you would have appreciated at the time?
Yeah, and going back to like being young and it all being a bit of a whirlwind, like, I think management early on would have, we kind of went through a different management, and I guess we never got fully comfortable with someone or whatever. But yeah, we could have definitely done with some guidance, definitely on the fact that we toured more than we should have been in the studio, like you mentioned earlier, Adam.
Are you a psychotherapist by day now, Adam? Is that right?
Both, really. You know, I'm really lucky enough to see maybe two or three one-to-one clients every day. I'm just finishing my doctorate off, so that's all coming together. And I also, you know, do music every day. So I'm really lucky in that sense. I'll either be playing music just to be able to play or going towards probably release another EP. And it's nice because I can tour when I want to tour, can release when I want to release. It'll all be peer funded. I feel really privileged, to be honest, in that situation.
Peer funded, how does that work? Sorry.
I guess that means that people are going to fund it who want to buy it. Maybe that's the wrong word.
Right, okay.
Crowdfunded, not peer funded. Peer support group I'm doing, and this is crowdfunded. You know, pledge music type stuff, although that's folded now. There's other avenues to get patrons and stuff. Crowdfunding, I think I've got a nice, firm, secure fan base that enable me to do small tours and to self-release still. So I'm really lucky, you know. I mean, I don't have to do it, which is really nice.
When did you get into the psychotherapy kind of side of it?
6 years ago, I started training. I got into it through my own experience on the other side of the chair, really struggling and realizing that there's not many people that understand A, being a musician, B, being a musician in the music industry, and C, being a musician in the music industry with a lot of media hype and all the fame that's involved with that. And, you know, and adding to that substance struggles, I think there's very few therapists that understand those different lenses. So I thought, well, that'd be really interesting. And I really enjoy working with musicians in that sense. And really, there's something that you can't read about in books. So that's how I got into it, really.
Is that quite a rewarding job, obviously?
It's great, yeah, especially when, you know, and I can talk from experience. I'm not just saying to people, you know, don't do this and do that. It's like, well, you can do this, but from my experience and some of the people I work with, this may be the outcome of whatever you choose to do.
Yeah, just finish on the Tonic Rider stuff. Like, where can people find that? Is it all online?
Yeah, if you just go to tonicmusic.co.uk, or there's loads of stuff online, just Google Tonic Music. Like I say, it's a local initiative, but during these COVID times, they're really pushing it out to support as many musicians and people in the industry as possible. I think in times like this, even just checking in weekly with other people in the same boat, it's so valuable. You know, having a chance to really express how you feel. There's so many people are now isolated. And I think out of everybody that's suffered through this whole pandemic, no one more than musicians. You know, everything's been taken away, from sense of identity to income, all these different things that people have ploughed their life into. And the government don't seem to be doing anything about it.
I guess the not knowing when things are back to normal must be even worse kind of thing.
Yeah, it's horrendous. It really is. You know, it's people's livelihoods. And we, all of us, I don't think there's a person in this world that isn't moved by music. And it can be a very sterile environment. And I think something like this could really kill some of the more organic, grittier musical creatives. And, you know, for those musicians that are safe, that's fine. But I think the up-and-coming people that are really, I don't know, just really infused and don't have that big backing, they're the ones that are going to be wiped out from this.